this is Danielle from The Jealous Curator, and this is episode 77 of Art for Your Ear. This episode is supported by Saatchi Art, the world's largest curated online gallery offering original art by independent artists from around the world. You can visit them at saatchiart.com. Now, I know I say that same little spiel every week, but stay tuned because we're shaking it up. They have a really, really great giveaway coming up in a few weeks for the holidays, which, of course, I will let all of you know about as soon as I have the details. So stay tuned on that one. Okay, so today, this is the 77th episode, but it is the first time I have done this. This conversation did not take place in my pillow fort of a home studio. No, today's chat was held in Portland at a gorgeous shop called Hand Eye Supply that you totally have to go to if you're in Portland or when you go to Portland. It is at 427 Northwest Broadway. It is so beautiful. You gotta go. Okay, and I was there with artist, illustrator, Lisa Congdon, and not just the two of us, a live audience who came along for the ride. It was so much fun. So this is definitely not going to be the last time I do this. If anybody's listening and has a space for me to show up and record this live, I'll bring my mic and I will show up because it is so much fun. So Lisa and I decided to sort of interview each other about things like inner critics, imposter syndrome, et cetera, et cetera. And then we turned the questions over to the crowd. I hope you love it as much as we love doing it. Here we go, stepping back in time to last Friday night in Portland. Oh, and FYI, you may hear the odd motorcycle or big truck drive by, so roll with it. Okay, let's do this. Me and Lisa and some of you at Hand Eye Supply in Portland. Hi, everybody. I don't even know, do I even need this? We're recording an episode of my podcast tonight, which is so fun. So Lisa and I are basically going to interview each other, and then we want to have you guys in it too. So then you can ask your questions, and then they'll be in the podcast.
So be thinking about your questions now so that there's not this like long, horrible...
Yeah.
Not that you couldn't edit that out.
Well, and interrupt us because we could probably talk for 7 hours. We have a habit of going for dinner and then talking and talking and talking and talking. And there's usually fries and rosé, so we're like, oh, we should have had it.
I know.
Anyway, so we'll just get started. Well, let's talk about what you were just saying. So funny.
Yeah, so I thought a really interesting story for you guys would be to share with you something that happened at a dinner date we actually had about 2 years ago. I live here now in Portland, but I was living in Oakland, California at the time. And Danielle curated a show at Bedford Gallery, which is a gallery I had shown at also previously. And so I was part of, what was the name of that show?
It was a jealous curator. It was basically my book Creative Block hung on a wall, which was really cool.
Yeah, and so she was in town, so I took her to one of my favorite French restaurants.
We ordered fries and rosé.
And so we sit down, and I knew Danielle had started working on a book, but I didn't know what the book was about. And so I was like, tell me what you just started a new book. Tell me what it's about. And so she proceeds to tell me that she's writing a book about your inner critic. And then I was like, okay, well, how's that going? And she basically, you almost started to cry.
Yeah.
Because maybe not so ironically, your inner critic was telling you that you shouldn't be writing this book because you weren't qualified.
Right.
So tell us a little bit about that.
Well, it was so funny because Art Inc. was done.
Had it come out yet?
It hadn't come out yet, but you were done.
Okay.
And I was freaking out. So I had signed the contract and everything was underway, and then it was time to write the book, and I was like, I don't know how to write a book. And so we went for dinner, and I knew she had just finished Art Inc., and you're not technically, you know, neither of us were trained as writers. And so I was like, how did that go? Tell me everything. I need to know details. What do I do? And it was such a good talk. It was just like this huge weight off my shoulders to know that somebody else that was like me, that was a friend of mine, had just gone through it. And you had so much good advice. And
well, I think what's interesting, too, is that I mean, this whole idea that I had for the first time, I have, you know, I have like, I'm working on my seventh book now, so I have a lot of books, but that was the only one that I wrote from start to finish. And you had also published two books, but it was the first one that you were writing most of. You have a little, some interviews in there, but,
yeah.
And that was really the thing that was freaking her out. It wasn't making a book, it was writing a book.
Yeah.
And I had had this really stressful process in writing Art Inc. And so, but I had gotten through it.
Yeah.
So,
see,
I gave you a pep talk.
I just followed behind you. Tell me this and tell me this. Yeah, it was a very weird process, very meta. That's for sure. Yeah.
So, and I was telling her about how I remember I turned in, I turned in the manuscript in chunks. And one of the things that was really hard for me was that, I was writing a business book for artists and I'm self-taught. I never went to art school. I felt like an outsider in the art world. I still do a lot of the time. And so I was like, who am I to write this book? And they said, Chronicle said, that's why we want you to write it, because you sort of figured this out on your own. So you can, you know, come from somebody who's not talking about it from somebody who's actually lived it and experienced it and sort of built something from the ground up. And the first time I turned in the first section of the manuscript, my editor came back and she said, you have to be more authoritative. Because I was like writing it like, well, this is what worked for me, but if it doesn't work for you, you know, you might try this. And they're like, no, people buy books like this because they want to hear from an expert. They want to know what to do. So you have to like own it, you know, be more authoritative. So that was something that I told Danielle, like, talk about this like you know what you're talking about, because really you do.
Yeah.
Even though
that was the best advice, because you know, it's sort of the balance of being an authority, because I certainly do have an inner critic that's a big jerk. So, you know, I'm an authority.
Yeah.
But without being like self-deprecating.
Right.
It's a weird balance.
You also want to have humility. You don't want to come across as being pompous or a know-it-all either. So yeah, it's a very delicate balance to strike.
Well, and I don't know if you guys have heard that I've talked about this on the podcast before, but when I first started writing it, I just had a full-on panic attack because I opened up the laptop and I was just like, oh my God, it's just a blank Microsoft Word document. And they want 30,000 words. I was just like, I am very, 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 like, how can I get to 30,000 words? And so, yeah, I just had this panic attack, and I was trying to figure out how to get out of the deal, and then I thought, well, I'll just write this, you know, because that's what I do with my art now, you know, from doing creative block. I learned so much from the interviews that I got from all of these guys, and so that's what I do in the studio now, right? It's you just make crap, and if it's not good, you throw it on the floor, and you try again, and so I thought, well, it's just a Microsoft Word doc. Like, I can delete. Mm-hmm. And, like, I cannot submit it. So I was like, I'm just going to go. And so it was just, like, stream of consciousness panic attack. I'm like, oh, my God, what am I doing? And I wrote the panic attack. And I sent it to my editor. And I was like, so here's where I am. Mm-hmm. And she wrote back and said, I love it. Keep going. And we ended up cutting a lot of the panic attack out. Hence, you know, looking like an expert and not somebody who needed to be medicated. But I just did that all the way through. Every time I sort of hit this, like, you know, every chapter was, I cried a lot writing this book because every single chapter was a demon that I had to face because I'm a creative person too. And these are the truths mm-hmm. we face. And I, you know, I talk about sharing your work. Well, I mean, I was terrible about sharing my own work.
You were.
I know. And I finally, like, I mean, I'm getting there. I'm still not that good at it, but I was like, how can I write a chapter about sharing your work when I don't even show my mom? I was like, so that's pretty bad. So I forced myself to start sharing on Instagram and actually hashtagging my own work with my real name. And so it's like baby steps, right? But this was, yeah, it was so funny. I was like, I should have just titled this book like Meta Moment because it was inner critic all the way. But Lisa's actually in this book. I interviewed her because we were talking. There's a section. You were the first person.
I'm in all your.
You
books.
Are in all of my books. That's just my go-to. Okay, let's see. Here's a new book. Let's call Lisa. See what she can add. And so, one of the things I'd never heard it before until you said it was imposter syndrome, mm-hmm. and I I mean, when I started the blog, I was already a fan of you. I wrote about you long before we ever knew each other. And to hear you say that you felt like an imposter and that you felt like you didn't, you know, that you didn't know what you were doing or whatever, as an outsider, I was like, what? And so we've talked about that a lot over fries and whatnot. And so when I was writing this chapter about labels and people putting labels on themselves, so, you know, oh, I'm self-taught, so it doesn't count, or I dropped out of art school, so it doesn't count, or I'm just a mom, or I work in a cubicle all day, so I can't really be an artist, and it's like all of those things. Hell yeah, you can. And so one of the huge things that comes up over and over and over is self-taught versus formal education. And so, of course, I had to call this one. And so I interviewed Lisa about being self-taught, and then I interviewed Shauna, oh my gosh, I'm blanking on her, Alterio, yeah. About, because she did an MFA. And so I just wanted to see, you know, and compare them side by side. And it's just so cool because both of them are hugely successful. They took completely different paths. They took paths that worked for them. And so you actually talk about imposter syndrome. Mm-hmm. And so are you over that now?
Well, the thing that I think is important for people to understand is that, so I used to think that when I was first starting out, or when I started to make it a little bit, or started to see things happening in my art career, once I had just sort of decided that that's what I was going to do, I used to think, I was so terrified, and I felt like, really, imposter syndrome is about your inner critic, and mostly it's about what you think other people are going to think of you.
Yeah.
It's an actual thing that I gave a talk last month where I actually did a little research on it, and it's actually like a psychological term that these doctors coined back in the 70s or 80s. And it's for successful people who sort of have this sense that they can't actually own what they've achieved, or that they don't qualify, or somehow it's been luck. And I didn't know that at the time. And I thought that the way I was feeling, or the way that I thought other people were viewing me, which sort of in the back of my mind was like I would show up at a party or something where there were other artists, and in my mind's eye, they're all standing over there going, ah, there's Lisa, you know, she's not a real artist like us. And what I realize now is like no one was talking about me at all because no one cared. You know what I mean? Like you always think that everyone's talking about you, but really nobody's talking about you.
Right.
But I also thought at the time that if I just achieved something in my career, like I got asked to be in a show at a major gallery, or I got some illustration client that I had been lusting after, that I would all of a sudden not feel this way anymore, that I would have some sense of like internal, intrinsic accomplishment, and that I would no longer feel intimidated or like I didn't belong or that other people were judging me. And then those things started to happen, and guess what? I still felt that way. And so the reason I'm saying that is I think it's important for people to understand that it never really goes away, and I understand that that's true now from talking to other people who did go to art school and did go through all the traditional channels, that many of them, in particular women, I think it's really common among women because we're taught to believe that we don't deserve what we get oftentimes in society. And so, I found out that this is sort of a universal thing, and that I'll never forget, I had this class from California College of the Arts come to my studio in Oakland when I lived in California. And I was talking a little bit about imposter syndrome. It was like an off-the-cuff kind of like studio visit talk. And there was a gentleman there who was one of the professors, and he's a really well-known, accomplished designer who now teaches at the college. And I was sort of explaining, this was years ago, and I was sort of explaining that, you know, why I thought I had imposter syndrome. And he interrupted me, and he was like, I still think amazing things happen for me, and I still feel like I don't deserve them, or that somehow somebody's made a mistake or whatever.
Yeah.
So I tell this story a lot about how I got this invitation in the mail to be in a show at the Contemporary Jewish Museum in San Francisco. And I opened it, and my wife Clay can tell you this. Like, I went into the kitchen, I was like, oh, they've made a mistake. They have the wrong Lisa Congdon. Like, there's no possible way I could possibly have gotten this. Like, in fact, it took me 3 days to respond to the woman, the invitation to be in the show at this museum, because I was so afraid that if I emailed them and told them that I would say, that I indeed was saying yes, that she was going to write back and say, oh, I'm so sorry, this was a big mistake, you know? We didn't actually want you to, you know, like, that's how deep, and I really authentically felt that way. So to answer your question, I feel that way much less now. I really turned a corner, and I think the corner I turned is that I now recognize my inner critic, or the sort of, like, for lack of a better word, the bullshit meter.
Yeah.
You know, like, I recognize that as a thing that's not real. Like, it's something that I've invented in my own head. And so I have to figure out, I have, like, ways that I sort of deal with that, as opposed to in the beginning it felt real. I did honestly feel like genuinely like an imposter. Now I catch myself feeling that way, and I can move past it because I know it's...
How do you move, like, you recognize it and just sort of put
yeah,
it on
yourself?
Yeah,
I sort of sit with it, and I also, like... you know, I just recognize it.
Just
and
flip
it
through all the books and magazines you've been in, like, oh yeah, there I am again.
Well, no, I mean, not really. I think in a way, like, that makes it worse somehow.
Yeah.
But just more like remembering, I don't know, that I'm just a real human being, and I have accomplished a lot, and that it's okay for me to own that. Mm-hmm. That I actually worked really hard, and I have a lot, you know, I've had a lot of amazing things happen in my life, and that it actually feels better to celebrate that instead of continually telling myself I don't deserve it, and that I can still be a humble person and celebrate my successes. And I just recognize it as an inner critic and not as really part of who I am.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, there are all kinds of ways that I do that, you know, that are probably really subtle, but...
Yeah. Well, it's funny because my dad, the day I got my advanced copy, my parents were visiting, and my dad's a PhD scientist. So he got right on the couch, started reading the book. And when he got home a few days later, he phoned me and he said, well, now, I don't know why you think this is an art problem. And he said, because scientists have this too, you know. And I was like, well, yeah, I think it's a human problem, but I don't write about science, Dad, so I kind of have to focus on my thing. And he said, oh, and he's telling me all these stories about, you know, how scientists, like, would worry about all this stuff and have imposter syndrome. And, when I spoke at Pixar, which I couldn't, you know, what am I doing at Pixar? Like, imposter syndrome.
I remember you spoke
yeah.
at Pixar.
Yeah. Oh my God.
I think it was, like, that last time that you were.
Yeah, it was. Yeah. And I just thought, what the heck am I doing here? But I talked anyway. And then afterwards, all of these people, all the animators, everybody came up and said, oh my God, I felt like you were talking just to me. And I was like, what? And, you know, they all had blocks and inner critics. And what I thought was interesting, what you said about even people that are formally trained feeling like this, it was really funny because if you talk to somebody who went to school for painting, they might feel pretty good about that, or, you know, maybe they've been doing it for a while, but they do photography on the side. And because they don't have formal education, because they're formal education people, because they don't have a degree in photography, it doesn't count. So, you know, they'll say, like, these Pixar guys, one was, like, you know, he's a super accomplished animator and everything, and but he said, you know, on the side I do photography and whatever. And he's like, well, like, I didn't go to school. And I was like, pardon? And he said, well, I take pictures, but, like, I'm not trained. So he couldn't be a photographer because he didn't have a degree on his wall that said photographer, you know? So I think everybody's got, you know, PhD scientists and, you know, everybody's got their thing. And you're totally right. It's just the inner critic finding a way to get to you.
I had this moment that was actually really both sort of humbling and exciting and slightly terrifying for me. So in May... I gave the commencement address at Minneapolis College of Art and Design. The woman who didn't start drawing or painting until she was in her 30s and who has no art degree. And so I was so honored when they contacted me and asked me. But, you know, I had this moment, I was in a cap and gown.
Yeah.
Walking with all the faculty.
Oh, I'm so used to this outfit.
Yeah. And I had this moment of, like, it was so thrilling for me. Because I never, you know, like, I went to college,
yeah,
but I didn't get my MFA or, you know, go to art school. And so it was, and, you know, I stood in front of all of these students and faculty and grad students and gave this talk. And yeah, it was like both terrifying and because there is something I think, especially in our culture, in American culture, about going to school and getting trained. And I think that that's really changing, especially in the art world. There's such a growing appreciation for people for the DIY. I mean, I think the DIY movement has really helped that, but also just sort of in general, the internet has allowed people to just, and nobody who's looking at your art is being like, did they go to art school?
Yeah.
They don't care.
Yeah.
People just want to look at cool things.
Yeah, so, totally.
Yeah.
Well, you know, this is funny because this wasn't on my little list of questions for you, but before we started, we were just talking because I noticed this amazing new tattoo. Lift that up. Lisa Congdon on Lisa Congdon. And it's new.
Yeah, it's my first, it's the first thing I've ever drawn that I've had. I've done, I don't do tattoos for people anymore because they're way too personal and it stresses me out. In fact, I just told my cousin I would draw her a tattoo and I'm like so regretting it.
You heard it here, cousin. You heard it here. She's not doing it.
Yeah, so anyway.
I thought it was just interesting that you've never.
For years, I was telling Danielle, for years, people would always be like, oh, do you, because I have a lot of tattoos, they'd be like, "Do you? Are any of those your own artwork?" And I'd be like, oh, God, no. I would never draw something and put it on my own body. And she was like, why? And I was like, because for the longest time, I didn't think my work was good enough. Or I was like, that thought would just like, not just terrify me, it would be like, repulsive. And then all of a sudden this year I was like, I think I'm gonna get my own work tattooed on me. And so like that was another moment where I was like, I must have overcome a lot.
Yeah,
you know,
every time imposter syndrome kicks in, you can just be like, hello there. Yeah. Full sleeve. Yeah, and it's so beautiful and it's so you. And Clay pointed out too that it's really cool, like that's your drawing hand.
And, I like,
and
I
it's like it just like comes
flows
right
onto the page.
There yeah so for the podcast people listening, we're going to have to put a picture of that.
Okay.
Otherwise, they'll be like, what are you
it's
talking
still
about?
Still healing, so I haven't photographed it
okay,
yet.
Okay, okay,
yeah.
We'll wait. Okay, let's see. What else was I going to ask you?
Mm-hmm. I have a question mm-hmm. for you.
Oh, okay.
Well, you know, we were talking about how, because I think people think that someday, like, if they do have an inner critic or they feel like an imposter in some way, that they think it's going to go away eventually if just certain things happen. And I think while it might lessen or you might find ways to sort of deal with it. It never really goes away. So it's kind of a thing that's part of why I love your book is like strategies for sort of coping with a lifelong inner critic because they don't ever really go away. I think you'd have to like be a super enlightened human being to not have an inner critic. So what's your like, of all of the things that you discuss in your book as sort of ways to deal with your inner critic, like what are your favorites in the book, either for yourself personally or that you've heard other people talk about?
One of my favorites came from a kid. I was teaching a high school workshop and this one kid, well, I asked them all, they were ages 14 to 17. And I said, when I say inner critic, do you guys know what I'm talking about? And sadly, they all knew very much what I was talking about. This was an arts festival, and so they all had to apply to come. So they were kind of like all the weird kids from around, you know, and like in their schools, they were the weird kids, but together they were like this amazing, like cape wearing pack of creative geniuses, you know, and they have like strength together, you know, so they really participated and they would say anything. And so, but they did have inner critics because a lot of them were bullied. And so I asked them, you know, well, what do you call your inner critic? Because I really hate the term inner critic, actually. Mm-hmm. And I said, what do you call yours? And so there was all sorts of mini-me and asshole and this and that. And then this one boy who was 16 or 17 said, well, I call mine Arlo. And, like, it just caught me off guard. And, like, I just, like, was dying of laughter. And his name was Arlo. And he's like, it's just an extension of me. But he's like, I just call him, like, Arlo. And I was like, I want an inner critic named Arlo. And so I named mine Arlo. And so now, and I tell everybody, like, come up with a name, like something just ridiculous that, you know, isn't threatening, like Lydia or, you know,
right.
Mr. Bunny.
Don't give them so much power.
Yeah,
give
don't
them a
give
name.
Them, yeah, just give them this name so that it's, because otherwise it's like this big, scary, floaty thing. And I've been thinking about this lately just in the last few weeks of doing these talks that, you know, when you have a nightmare and you wake up and you're just by yourself in your room and you're awake now, but it's still scary.
Oh, yeah, totally.
And then even you might go to work or whatever, and it's still in your mind. And then if you tell somebody and you're like, yeah, oh, I just had this really scary, like there was this shark and like it came through my window. And like, as soon as you say it out loud, you're like, well, that's really stupid. And it's like not scary at all. But if you just leave it in your head to fester, it just sort of bothers you and it's a bit haunting. And I think that's what the inner critic is, right? Like if you don't name it, if you don't say it out loud, if you don't talk to other people about it, it becomes this monster that just grows and grows and grows. And so I really like the idea of naming it. I really like the idea of talking about it. I mean, I didn't know other people had inner critics. I thought I was the only one that had that voice because I never told anybody. I was, you know, working as a very successful creative director in the design business. I never wanted to tell anybody. Like, it was all bravado, right? Mm-hmm. So I never wanted to be like, hey, FYI, I'm totally insecure. Yeah. How about you? No? Oh, okay, great. So nobody ever talks about it, right? And so I think talking about it. And then the other thing I love, 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 somebody told me this a couple of years ago, is say thank you. So if somebody compliments your new tattoo or whatever it is, and you throw out a million excuses of why it's not quite right, you know, so if somebody tells me they love my collage, I now say thank you. Even if in my head I'm thinking of a zillion other things, you know, things that I'm not quite happy about, if you say thank you, as opposed to saying, well, I don't really love that color and I wish I'd cut this a little bit better, because then your inner critic is like, all right, like here we go. I went, and you know, it's just negative, 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 instead of just seeing the positive. And every time you do that, that power gets taken away. He has his name, Arlo goes and sits on his little bench. And that's, you're right, like I don't think it'll ever go away, but if you can minimize it and have it be this little thing that is not part of you, it's just external, you know, these external things that have come about and turned into this big monster, you can kind of settle it down and put it over there and then just keep going. Like that's what I learned from you guys in Creative Block, was just show up. And I know that that's talked about a lot lately, but it's so true. Like I quit. I just quit. I didn't think I'd quit. I thought I was still an artist. I just didn't make anything for 15 years.
Well, yeah, and I think people assume that artists who are really prolific don't have an inner critic.
Yeah.
But everybody has an inner critic. Everybody deals with insecurity and self-doubt. Everybody.
Yeah.
Those people, myself included, we just keep showing up even though we have self-doubt.
Yeah, and
that
you might
takes
have
a certain amount of stamina, for
yeah,
sure.
Yeah, and you might have days or weeks even where nothing great comes out, but you keep going. Mm-hmm. And when something great didn't come out of me every single time, I was like, well, I'm just not an artist, so I better just quit. And one of my favorite stories, when I was touring for Creative Block, I met this guy whose dad had worked for Andy Warhol back in the day. Like, how cool would that be?
Yeah.
And he said that Andy pulled thousands and thousands of prints that no one ever saw, because he just wasn't happy with the composition or whatever, just didn't like them. And so they would go to the dumpster behind the building. And if any of the interns took them, you'd be immediately fired. So they were actually all burned. They were incinerated. And but when you think about Andy Warhol, you just think about those masterpieces, you know, like, even when I talk to non-arty people, they can name five Andy Warhols, right? And right. You just assume that he walked into the studio and was like, hello, Marilyn. Like, you know, and it was just like perfect the first time out. But there were literally thousands that he wasn't happy with that were burned. And so you can't get to the Marilyn if you don't do those thousands that get That's tossed. Right. And so when I heard that story, I probably cried. I cry a lot. I was just like, oh. That's nice, you know? Yeah. And so now when I make, I'm just not precious. And I just, you know, toss stuff on the floor, flip it over, try again, and don't worry about it. And I might have studio days where it sucked the whole day, but then I'll go back in. And I think that's when your inner critic quiets down, because they kind of realize they don't have much power anymore.
That's right.
Yeah.
I think it's particularly hard right now because of social media, and there's a lot of pressure to put your work online, especially if you want to make something of yourself as an artist, and it's not just sort of this internal thing for you. And I think part of why we make stuff is because we want to share it with other people, and so now we have this way to do that. And so there's an enormous amount of self-doubt that comes from that, you know, no matter what level of your career or your art practice, if it's not a career for you that you're in, I think sort of the public nature of being a maker these days is compounds this sense of doubt and insecurity.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it's something
that we need to confront.
Yeah, I talk about it in here about sharing, because I'm writing this chapter about sharing. But then it's also like, when not to share, mm-hmm. you know, because there is so much pressure with social media that you're supposed to share everything, like every doodle, every thought is supposed to be out there. And it's just like, A, that's totally overwhelming. And B, if it's not ready to be shared, you're going to get comments that might stop you. So it's this weird balance of when do you share it? I don't know. It's just a really hard thing, you know? I didn't really start putting mine out there until I really liked it. You know, and I was at the point where I thought, you know, if some troll comes along and says something mean, I'm going to be like, "F you, I don't care. I really like it." And that took me a really long time to get there, you know? And so I used to Instagram like a corner of my collage or like the process, because then nobody could really say anything, because it's like, well, it's just a tiny corner. And then so this Christmas when I was writing this chapter, I was like, okay, Danielle, like it's time to show a full piece. And I was really happy with them. So I was like, come what may, you know, and I mean, they've been generally really nicely received. And when they're not, I don't care.
Your Instagram following has like exploded since you've been posting your own art. So there you go.
Well,
people want to see what you do.
I know. Well, it's just so weird. Anyway, enough about me. So before I'm going to turn it over to you guys to ask questions, the other thing that I really love, and we've talked about this, and so you included it in the interview. I probably set you up so that you'd have to, is your painting curve thing. I love that. Mm. Can you tell them what that
is? Sure. I first wrote about this in Art Inc., and it actually, so I am self-taught, but I did in the very sort of formative years, I take some art classes, and I happened to study with this one teacher for about a year and a half. And so I took three or four sort of semester-long courses from him. And he used to talk about the painting curve. And the painting curve is like, and this is going to be especially relevant for people but I think the sort of it's a metaphor for life.
Yeah.
But sort of literally speaking, so if you're a painter like me who paints on canvas or wood or anything where you're layering a lot of, you know, things dry, then you put another layer on and you're working through things, whether you're painting abstractly or representationally, it doesn't matter. In the beginning, when you first lay stuff down, everything looks really beautiful and perfect and you almost want to leave it there, but then the painting really has no depth to it. And then the more paint you start adding, like the messier things get, and then things get a little messed up and look really muddy and bad. And that's the point at which you want to like rip the painting up and throw it away. But actually, that's the place where if you sort of step back or push through that and then work the painting to the end, like continue to work with it, like that's where the magic happens. Because that's where all the layers of paint are, and then like some of the muddy stuff becomes beautiful when you know, work through it. And I got really hooked on that analogy that he used to call it the painting curve. It's kind of like the bell curve, like whatever. And it's so funny because people email me all the time and they're like, was Larry Robinson your painting teacher? Like, he's famous for this.
Oh yeah.
Everybody who studied with him knows about the painting curve, and I wrote about it in my book. And actually, a funny story, he emailed me about 2 weeks after the show at the Contemporary Jewish Museum opened, and at that point I had not taken a class from him for 5 or 6 years. Like, I had moved on to become a professional artist. He never knew that that happened. So I took my very first painting classes with him. He recognized my name, and he emailed me, and he was like, wait, are you the Lisa Congdon who... There aren't very many of us. And I was like, yes, as a matter of fact, I am. And I just finished a book where I like talk about your painting curve. So it was kind of like this moment that I will never forget. He's a pretty well-known guy and had gone to the show and whatever. So that's the painting curve. And I try to think about that when I'm like in a really messy place.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, if you work on paper and you get it too messy, you just got to rip it up and start over.
But that's what I think. That's why I think it's a good analogy, because my collages are so simple, right? It's like there's two elements and it's on white. And if it doesn't work, there's no pushing through. Like,
yeah,
you're done.
Right.
But I think you toss that and then you get, you know, you keep going and you keep going and you come out somewhere with, I might have 5 discarded ones and I come out on the other side of it with the one that I'm actually happy with.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And that's another way to look at it. And I think, too, like that moment when you want to rip things up or put them away or whatever. Not that putting things aside isn't a bad idea. It's often a good idea. is actually where most of the pain is.
Yeah.
And that's when you want to, that's where the inner critic is, you know, always rearing its ugly head. And especially when you start out really excited about a painting or a drawing or an idea, and then it's not, you know, coming out. But then sometimes the thing that you imagined and it turns out differently is actually even better than what you imagined because of the twists and turns of the creative process. So yes, the painting curve.
Yeah, I love it. I'm going to turn it to you guys. Do you have any questions? Yeah?
On the subject of quote-unquote failures, do you guys ever post anything of yours that you want, like that one of those things you know,
I'm going to repeat that question so that the people at home can hear what you said. We were asked if we ever post the failures, the things that we're not happy with and that end up on the floor.
Do you? I have in the past, yes. I've also, another thing I've done is shown people, both in classes that I've taught and in various blog posts that I've written, I'll take process photos to show people that what something ends up looking like in the end is very different than what it looked like in the middle. Even if I have a very straightforward idea of what I'm doing that, you know, because oftentimes in my illustration work, I have to sketch something out. I actually have to tell the client like this is what I'm gonna draw for you and they approve it. And then I have to I can't make changes. Like that's part of my job. My personal work's a little different, but even in those situations, like what something starts off looking like is quite different than the end, but especially in my personal work. And I think it's important for people to see that, because I think sometimes people just imagine that you walk in and sit down and that, like you said about Andy Warhol, that like you sort of magically just sort of make this thing in a very short period of time. And you know what? Sometimes that happens. Like sometimes there's those days when everything goes right. And more often than not, that's not the case. And either you can never get to the end and you don't ever show it, or you just are like, or, you know, you work through it. So I've definitely showed process. And I think on occasion I've showed things that I started working on that I wasn't happy with, or admitted that I wasn't happy with them. Like I do a lot of personal projects where I do something either every day or once a week. And because oftentimes I don't have time to make it right because I got to post it because it's a weekly project, I have to post something that I'm not very happy with. And I'll admit very freely that I don't really like it, but here it is anyway. So I guess I do that quite a bit, actually.
I don't. I probably should practice what I preach.
Yeah.
Well, it's interesting to put a disclaimer on, like, you know, you make sure that people know that it's something
that I'm not happy with, yeah.
That's right. That is my
inner critic. Right, and you know, what's so interesting is that a lot of times the stuff that I don't like, people go nuts for. And the stuff that I'm so proud of, like, I'm going to take a picture of this, I'm going to put it on my Instagram account, and people are going to go nuts. And then it just doesn't, like, you know, like, three people might be like, oh, that's pretty. Whatever. Are you kidding? It's amazing. You don't love this? And then I'll put something up that I think is like whatever, and people go, it gets like 6,000 likes or something, and I'm like, what are you talking about? This is horrible. So that's just it. Like, you just never, or the thing that took you 5 minutes because you were rushing really resonates for people, and the thing that you spent 3 weeks on, nobody cares about. Yeah. So, and that's the thing, is like ultimately you have to make work for you, and you have to make work that feeds you. You know, you want to sell your work and you want people to hire you if you're an illustrator. So you got to make work that resonates for people too. Like there has to be this intersection, but at the end of the day, it's what you like and it is meaningful to you that I think is the most important. But I also think sharing stuff that you don't like, or that's part of your creative process that doesn't end up going anywhere, is also really an important part of the process. And it's important for other people to see too, that creative people don't just magically produce things.
I'm just sitting here thinking of all this because I don't do that. And I think, here's my inner critic at work. I'll post a collage that I like. And if it doesn't do well, I delete it. And then think about it. And it's usually the title is wrong. But do you guys know my collages? So I do hilarious titles, right? And sometimes, like, I'm always really happy with the composition, or I wouldn't photograph it. But sometimes the titles aren't right, and I just can't get the words quite right, but I post it anyway because I really like the image and I want to, and it's always when the titles aren't quite right. And so it's almost like interesting feedback to me to put it up and be like, I didn't do well, and you know what? I'm not surprised because I wasn't really very happy with it either. So I'll delete it, and then I'll put it up again like 3 weeks later once I've like reworked the title. And then it always does better, and it's kind of like a weird like crit for me to be like, yeah, you know what? They were right. That wasn't very good. And yeah, I don't know why I don't show my... This is all really new for me, showing
well,
my own work.
And I also have to say, like, not...
You don't have to. No.
Like, I just finished recording this. I'm going to launch my own series of e-courses starting next week. And the first one is called Idea Generation, and it's about, like, coming up with ideas for what to draw and paint and, like, finding your voice. And so one of the things I talk about is this idea that if posting things for other people to see isn't motivating to you, like if you're going to do a project where you try to, like, work regularly and put it out into the world, if that is intimidating to you or if that scares you or if that prevents you from doing the thing, showing up and working regularly, then don't do it.
Yeah.
Like, only do that if it's motivating to you. I mean, I encourage people to try to share things because, especially if you want to become a professional artist or
right.
you want to grow your business, because that's really, you've got to get comfortable with sharing your work, but to a certain extent. But do what's motivating for you. And if that's not motivating for you, or if that doesn't make you feel good about your presence on the internet, that's okay.
That's what I meant in there, like, know when not to share. Like, you don't have to. And I think what I do is when I'm trying to work something out, I don't share it with the world because I don't want to know yet. And so I, this is really funny, a few years ago when I was doing the Girl Crush workshops,
mm-hmm.
I did a Girl Crush in Seattle and I brought some of my work. And just to show, like, we were just doing
so
work.
So just for you, those of you who don't know, Danielle did these series of workshops in 2011, 10, something like that.
12? I don't know.
No, it was 11 because I had that show at Gallery Hijinks.
Oh,
and we.
Oh, okay, yeah.
So she did one in my studio in when I was in San Francisco, but they're like for women and like an artist and Danielle, and then like, you know, 5 to 15 women would come and like spend the day together in an artist studio and like talk and make things. And
it was so cool.
So fun.
So the morning would be all this stuff, like inner critic, and there was always some crying and then we'd have a nice catered lunch. And then in the afternoon we would make art and eat sugar and drink coffee. And actually that's why I'm like giving Jamie a little look, because I'm going to do Girl Crush Vancouver. I haven't done one in years. And so we're going to do Girl Crush Vancouver in February. You heard it here live. So that'll be really fun. I'm excited to do one. Anyway, what was the point? Oh, yes. So I was doing Girl Crush Seattle at Assemble, which sadly is no longer open in Seattle. And the girls that ran it saw my work over my shoulder as I was, you know, working with everyone. And so afterwards, they were like, we want you to have a solo show. And I was like, what? And they said, yeah, like maybe like 18 new pieces. Like, what? And this was like far before the collage, like this is years ago. And so I was like, okay, because you don't say no, right? So I'm like trying to make all this stuff. I was keeping everything internal. I was freaking out. And so I was talking to another blogger friend of mine who's not an artist. And she was like, don't you have art friends that you can talk to about this stuff? And I was like, talk to other humans about my art? Like, no. And so I thought about it for, you know, a couple of weeks, and then I reached out to two artists in Vancouver. This is when I was living in Vancouver, Sarah G. Miller and Jessica Bell. And they knew me as the jealous curator, but they didn't even know that I made work.
No, none of us knew that you made art.
And so we were friendly, but we weren't friends, and I called them and said, could we do, like, I'll bring chocolate and you make the coffee because I want to talk to you guys about something. So they thought I was coming over to do something jealous curatory, and I showed up with all these collages, and they were like, what's this? And so we talked for probably 4 or 5 hours, and it was the most amazing creative afternoon I've ever had, because they didn't, you know, tell me it was all great. They gave me really constructive, amazing feedback, and which is what, it wasn't criticism, it was feedback, which is exactly what I needed. And I just remember thinking, like, oh my God, this was the first time since art school, so it'd been almost 20 years since I'd actually shown another artist my work and said, what do you think? And then it was just like, oh God, what if they tell me you should never paint again? You know, and so, but it was amazing. And that was sort of this moment that I was like, right. So that's when I, when I'm not quite sure about stuff. So I actually saw Sarah G a couple months ago, I guess, well, maybe last year before I started doing the collages I'm doing now. And I'd done a few pieces that I've never shown anyone, and I showed them to Sarah. And I said, what do you think? And she said, oh, I really like them. She's very sweet. I really, really like them. And then we said goodbye, and I went home. And I thought, really? So I emailed her, and I said, that was very nice that you said that you liked them, but what did you really think? Like, give me feedback. You know, why did you like them, if you really like them? And was there anything I could improve on? And she wrote me back and said, yep, you know what? You're right. I really like them, but I wish that they meant something, because they were just really random, like, graphic pieces. And she said, they're really beautiful, but, like, I wanted there to be a story. And she said, you tell so many stories. Why wasn't there a story? And I was like, huh. And I wasn't hurt. I wasn't defensive. I wasn't anything, because I respect her. But see, I never showed anyone, because I knew they weren't right. So I hadn't showed them on Instagram. I hadn't shown them to anyone. So if you can find a few, even one trusted person that you can have that kind of, you know, it's not quite right, and you can bat it around. Like, I, you know, I would show you. Lisa Golightly is a good friend of mine. I would show Lisa. I email her all the time, this or this. And she'll write back, A, like, thank you. And because I trust her. And then when I start to feel really good about things, then I share it with the world. Because then if a troll says something, I don't care, because I'm already good with what it is. So, well, that was the longest answer.
Do you get a lot of trolls saying things?
Nope.
I mean, I was.
But, you know, I braced myself.
You brought it up
twice.
Well,
now. I braced myself for it. Like, that's what I'm afraid of, right? Because, I don't think I've ever told this story in the podcast. Maybe once. But my big fear when I started Jealous Curator, I was completely anonymous. Remember that? Nobody even knew I was Danielle Crissa. I was just the Jealous Curator. And for the longest time, people thought I was a man in England. And I was like, okay. And I never corrected them. I just rolled with that. And the reason why, well, there were several, but one of the main reasons was I was so afraid that if I said Danielle Crissa, Jealous Curator, they would Google Danielle Crissa and find my art and realize that Jealous Curator taste was way up here and my actual artwork was way down here. And that I was terrified of that. And so, and everybody said, oh, you're crazy, you're crazy. Well, it happened. So about 2 years into the blog, I was Googling myself at 2 a.m, as you do, and up came this thing about my work, and I was like, oh my God, and nobody ever writes about my work, and so I went and read it, and this girl had written this blog post saying, I just discovered this work, it's the work of blogger, the Jealous Curator, and I was like, that's me, and she said, you'd consider, like, considering given her amazing taste in art, you wouldn't think that her art would be so trite and blah, blah, and, like, a direct rip-off of so-and-so, so-and-so, and so I'm like, my worst nightmare has happened, and I said to my husband, I knew it, and so I emailed Victoria Smith of SF Girl by Bay at 2 a.m, look at this, and I forwarded her the link, so she had some choice words about that girl, and she was like, she doesn't even have one comment, nobody's even reading that blog. I was like, it doesn't matter, like, somebody thought it, and so for years after that, I never shared again, because I was like, see? And so I think that's why I bring it up. Like, it's never really happened outside of that.
She wasn't a troll, though.
No.
I'm just saying.
She was just a mean blogger. But anyway, that's what
there's
I'm afraid of.
There's just mean people. Not that there aren't also trolls.
Yeah. But anyway, wow. Super long answer. Any other questions? Yep.
So I have a question. I feel like with the inner critic, sometimes there can be the opposite side of the spectrum, where it's like, the inner champion, but they can also be super obnoxious. Like, you have a little bit of success, and then you're like, oh, I'm awesome, and this, like, justifies everything, but then it's like, that's super out of balance too, right? So, like, how...
I don't have that.
Well, I guess when you get, like, some sort of success that you didn't really see coming, you're like, why did I get that? And I don't really deserve that. So, like, is it all the same? Or, like, how do you find the balance, you know?
I do think it comes from the same place.
Totally.
It's called your ego. And your ego wants so badly to make you, like, the ego is a funny thing because it's both responsible for making you feel good about yourself and making you feel bad about yourself. And it gets very attached to whatever message it thinks is going to do one or the other, depending on, you know, sort of, I don't know, the day. But I do think it comes from the same place. And I often sort of will, like, you know, the high of, not just if you're an artist and you get something amazing happens for you, but anything in your life, mm-hmm. where something great happens and you, you're sort of like, now everything's okay, but that's very temporary. And like any kind of external feedback that you get is going to either make you feel like an imposter or make you feel awesome or maybe both at the same time. And that's why I think it's really important to sort of get grounded in why you're doing what you're doing every day, because I can tell you that even from somebody who has a very successful career, like, some days are horrible and some days are really awesome. And I have to wake up every day and still show up and go to work, whether I feel good about myself or not. And, or whether somebody's, you know, said really terrible things about me, which happens, or praises me, or I get asked to do something that's, I find really prestigious or whatever. That, like, my mood and how I approach my work can't be dictated by either, like, whatever beautiful wave I'm on because I feel really good about myself that day because something really amazing happened, or by feeling terrible about myself because I don't like my work that day, or because somebody said something mean or questioned my judgment about something. That I have to, like, just be sort of, like, grounded in who I am as a person and why I do what I do every day, and the fact that, you know, that I love what I do and I'm going to put my best, you know, foot forward every day. Because I feel like if we're too focused on external, good or bad, it really can mess you up badly.
I actually, when you said that, I totally pictured, like, a little boxing match, you know, of your ego being like, oh, yeah. And the inner critic is just like, sit down, you suck.
Yeah,
it's really funny. My dad said when I was younger, because my mom doesn't understand me, you know, and, why are you so sad? Why are you so happy? Like, and my dad said the thing about Danielle is she's passionate. So her highs are much higher and her lows are much lower. And I don't know if it's just age or, if, you know, submerging myself in all of this for the last however many years, but it's sort of like when I'm on the high, I really just enjoy it now, because not that I'm like, oh, tomorrow I'm going to feel like crap. It's just like, I really enjoy it because I know there will be a day when the inner critic kicks back in. And but also when I'm down there and, like, the inner critic is kicking in, it's like, you know what? But I know I'm going to be back up there. And so it's just kind of accepting that, I think, and riding the wave.
Mm-hmm.
We work the painting curve into that somehow.
Yeah, and then there's, like, that famous quote, I don't know who said it, about, like, you know, our greatest fear isn't that we're going to fail, it's that we're going to succeed. I have a friend who, she lives here in Portland, and she's a really amazing illustrator, and she's sort of emerging into the scene and starting to get a lot of amazing clients and do this really amazing work. And the other day, she has a big client, and another illustrator who's pretty well known is working with the same client and went to Japan to launch this product line. And so I took a screenshot of this other person who we know in Japan launching this illustration she had done for this big company. And I sent it to my friend, and she was like, well, that terrifies me. And I said, what, because you think you're not worthy? And she said, no, like, the idea that could be me in a year, because she's working for the same company doing a similar thing, like, she's terrified of success in a way. It's like we all crave it, but it also terrifies us. So, and we're, like, sort of addicted to it and terrified by it at the same time.
There's that boxing match again. Okay, so let's do one more question. Yep.
So back to the topic of your title, because they are so narrative, are there any, like, books or other narratives or TV shows that kind of inspire you when you come up with your title?
The question was about my collages and my titles. No TV shows, nothing really inspires me. It's just, it's the little scene. Like, as soon as I do it, like, I've got a whole bunch of the way I work now, because I'm not being precious. I'm taking all the advice from Creative Block. I'm not precious. I'll put out a whole bunch of papers, and I'll just do brush strokes on all of them. And so I've got different colors and, like, swooshes and dots and whatever. And then I've got my big bowl of little cutout people, and I take them and I put them on the different blobs, and like some totally don't work, and it's always magic. I'll put one on and like I laugh out loud by myself in my studio like a crazy person, and as soon as I put it down, it's like I just get these weird little stories in my head, and my whole family has mocked me for years, like that I'm, you know, that I talk constantly and that I always have these little stories and whatever. So it's finally being channeled somewhere, and it's so fun. And also when I look at the little people, like their names just pop into my head too, you know, like I instantly, it's like, well, that's clearly Elaine, like how can it not be Elaine? And so I have so much fun in there, but yeah, it's just all from my weird brain. Oh, one more. Yep.
How do you know when you're through the muddy part of a piece? When it's your inner critic saying that you suck or that you really should be pushing yourself further?
That's such a great question.
How do you know when you're through the muddy part of a piece and if it's just your inner critic saying it or if you should?
Or you really should,
you really should just stop. Yeah.
Well, that's such a hard question. I don't know. And I think that like what I've learned to do is sort of trust my instinct and also put things away and sit with them for a while. Which in my professional life I can't do as often because I have deadlines. So sometimes I just need to start over. Even if the other thing that I started might have worked in the end, I just can't take the chance of messing it up even more. So I start over or whatever, or wasting more time on something that I'm going to have to start over in 2 hours, so I might as well start it over now.
I think that's good advice to put it away, though.
Yeah, so if you have the bandwidth and you're not working on a deadline to put something aside for a while, I think that's always the best way that to come back to it. And if you still feel the same way, like there's no hope for this, and a lot of times that has to do with your materials, because sometimes if you overwork your materials, they'll rip and they'll get destroyed, they'll disintegrate. Your canvas will no longer have teeth on it because it's got too much paint on it already or whatever, and like so that sometimes will determine it for you. But if all other things being equal, I would put it away and then come back to it. Another piece of advice that I give people when they're either trying to figure out if it's too far gone to finish or if it's finished or not is to ask other people what they think. Because we often lose perspective with our own creative work, knowing not whether something is, quote, good or not, but whether it's worth continuing or finishing, or whether, you know, we're onto something or not. I mean, I always think it's good to push through, but other people can often, and they don't even necessarily need to be artists. Like, does this look finished to you? Or do you think this has any hope? You know, ask somebody whose eye you trust. I don't have a studio mate now. Actually, that's not true. I just moved into a painting studio with my mother.
Isn't that awesome?
My mom's not a painter. She's a fabric artist. But she's like a textile artist. But she, I haven't asked her opinion yet because we've only been studio mates for a month. But I used to have this studio mate in Oakland. Actually, we were studio mates in San Francisco too, Jamie. And she did have her MFA and is an extremely accomplished artist. And it was such a great experience for me because I didn't go to art school. I never had the experience of asking people to critique my work before. And so it's the fact that you even like asked your friend to give you feedback was like so brave, because I still haven't gotten very good at doing that. But Jamie was so great, and she would ask me advice about her work, which I also made me feel like we were equals. That also helped me get over my imposter syndrome. But having someone whose eyes you trust, whether it's a fellow artist or your studio mate or whatever, like, this look done. This piece doesn't look right to me. What do you think? Like, what should I do? How could I fix it? Because we often don't know, or we lose perspective. And sometimes putting it away helps, and sometimes asking someone else helps.
Mm-hmm. And there's quite a few artists who I really admire, who, like Jennifer Davis, she'll put them away for ages and then pull them back out and be like, oh, that's not so bad, you know, or like flip it upside down and like, you know, repaint over it and it turns into something else. And so I think, because if you put it away for a bit, like even like a month or something, and come back to it, you'll know. Because it might have been your inner critic that day saying you suck, and because maybe actually, a zillion other things were happening.
This kind of harkens back to what you were saying earlier about like the sort of rush of like, oh, this is really awesome. This happens to me a lot. Like I'll start a new body of work and I'll just be like, this is so beautiful, because in my mind it's so new and different than anything I've done before.
It's exciting.
So this happened to me in January. I started this new body of work and I thought it was so amazing, and so I made several pieces and I just sort of like let them sit in my studio for a while. And every 3 weeks that passed, I hated them. I realized all of the flaws about them. And I was so glad that I didn't, like sometimes sitting with things will actually like make you realize that they're not as good as you thought they were.
Or they were first idea and you need to push yourself farther.
Yeah, or like that certain things about them you thought were unique and interesting, or that they're just unfinished and sort of like not clean enough because you haven't put enough effort into sort of finishing them. And so things are still a little muddy and unfinished. I do that a lot. Like I rush through things and then I like realize later that they really are not that developed. And because I am so anxious to like make something and share it that I do it too fast. And then I realize later that it kind of sucks. So,
I think that's it. First live Art for Your Ear.
Oh, really?
Well, it's not live because I'm editing it. But first, like, in a group, not me in my pillow fort. Yeah, so fun. Thank you guys so much.
Yay.
Yes, I am so doing that again. I love how generous Lisa is with her information and her own stories, and I really, really loved that I wasn't the only one asking questions. Those audience members had some really tough ones, but they were amazing. Once we were done chatting, we headed back into the main area at Hand Eye for a drink or two and a whole bunch of book signing. I always love hearing the stories of people who want this book. We really are one gigantic club of people who totally get it. So, yes, Your Inner Critic is a Big Jerk is finally on shelves everywhere, and the audiobook is officially ready to download on audible.com. And if you don't have an Audible account, you are welcome to use my link, which is audibletrial.com/jealouscurator, to get my book for free, or any book of thousands and thousands of titles for that matter, and a free 30-day trial that you can cancel whenever you like. Okay, thanks again to Saatchi Art for supporting this episode, and as always, thank you so much for listening. There will be more Art for Your Ear next weekend. See you then.